Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720. To Extension 720, I'm your host, Justin Kaufman. Tonight, exploring stories of marginalized communities, stories that used to be in the shadows, but maybe now seeing the light. A new mayor, a new day in Chicago, yet we continue to hear the same stories from the same sources. So tonight, let's explore new stories from new sources. The president has talked about closing the border between the U.S. and Mexico to stem the tide of undocumented immigrants coming across. As this issue plays out in Washington, a group of students in Chicago aim to tell the stories of the undocumented. A new podcast called Documentation talks about the stories of dreamers told by dreamers themselves. We'll talk with some of the students coming up. And are Chicago schools doing enough to teach the next generation of students several different languages beyond just English and Spanish? Five Chicago universities are coming together to start a program called Bilingual Matters. It's not just about the students, it's about finding the right teachers as well. We'll have that conversation coming up after 7:30. A new book out looks at the history of the gay nightclub scene in Chicago, particularly River North, before Billy Deck and Let Us Entertain You, Chicago's gay community, dominated downtown nightlife. Owen Keenan joins us to talk about Dugan's Bistro, The Bearded Lady, and the gay revolution of the 1970s. Also tonight, a new series debuts on Open TV. It's called Phobia, F-O-B-I-A. F-O-B stands for Fresh Off the Boat. The comedy follows an Indian woman and her struggles to adapt to a new environment on the other side of the world. We'll talk with Priya coming up later. And next weekend, the second annual iHeart Halal Festival returns to Navy Pier. We'll talk with the organizers about the Muslim-based festival and celebration of the halal lifestyle. All that, plus our neighborhood tours continue. We head to Hermosa Humboldt Park to talk with Lily B about growing up Mexican-American on the northwest side of the city. All that tonight on Extension 720. All right. But first, let's talk about being marginalized, shall we? I'm not even sure I understand what that means. It took me a while. But when we use the word, when we're talking about people, it means underserved, it means disregarded, ostracized, harassed, persecuted, sidelined. Sounds familiar. A lot of us can make the argument that we fit that criteria in some way or another, at home, at work, at play. But where it's most used is in a political arena, as certain communities are held down, restricted from positions of power, unable to affect change because, well, they're not allowed to lead it. But that may have changed this week in Chicago.
Together, we can and will finally put the interests of our people, all of our people, ahead of the interests of a powerful few. Together, we can and will make Chicago a place where your zip code doesn't determine your destiny.
Lori Lightfoot is the new mayor of Chicago. The African-American gay woman won in a landslide on Tuesday night, a victory for the marginalized, not just because of her identities, but for a whole group of Chicagoans that were fed up with not being seen or heard, many held down or disregarded for the betterment of a few. The New York Times went with Lightfoot wins on outside appeal. CNN went with Lightfoot bucks the system. Several more said Lightfoot beats the machine, and so on and so forth. But how about this from her victory speech?
Out there tonight, a lot of little girls and boys are watching. They're watching us. And they're seeing the beginning of something, well, a little bit different. They're seeing a city reborn. A city where it doesn't matter what color you are. And where it surely doesn't matter how tall you are. Where it doesn't matter who you love, just as long as you love. Let me say that again. Where it doesn't matter who you love, just as long as you love with all your heart. In the Chicago we will build together, we will celebrate our differences. We will embrace our uniqueness, and we will make certain that all have every opportunity to succeed.
She's right that little girls and boys can see themselves where maybe they hadn't before. And maybe it's contagious as more and more marginalized communities upend the apple cart, take hold of not just politics, but social, economic, and cultural life. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done, no doubt, and there won't be much of a honeymoon. But my little rant here isn't about the actual politics of the moment. It's more about celebrating a day and time where everyone can step out of the shadows, live their life how they desire and deserve. And it's not confined to Mayor-elect Lightfoot. Frankly, the idea of being left behind or marginalized is something we all seem to share. I feel left behind that my issues aren't being talked about by our current president, or your issues with the last president, or the president before him. And when marginalized by a person or a group in power, it just repeats itself. We just repeat ourselves. It's a vicious cycle. But you know what? I feel like I'm learning. I'm learning that maybe there isn't a right and a wrong. And outrage is not black and white. Maybe it's gray. There seems to maybe not even be a shared truth. But you know what there is? There's stories. And your story is as real and true as mine. And maybe if we hear more of these stories, we'd better understand ours, even if they are outside the margins. Of marginalized communities coming out of the shadows tonight on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new podcast series is telling the story of dreamers. But it's not some ivory tower project that examines the politics of immigration reform. No. Instead, it's a new series reported by Dreamers themselves and other Latinx students and alumni from Northeastern Illinois University. It's a project administered by the Online News Association. It's called Documentation, and it explores issues of family, mental health, education, and identity.
El miedo existe. El miedo siempre está.
Tener ese miedo de quien vaya a deportar.
Buscábamos una mejor... un mejor futuro para nuestras hijas.
No encuentran esas.
The podcast series is bilingual, but a bulk of it is in Spanish for Spanish public radio. But regardless of the language, the stories the students tell are the stories of their friends, their classmates, their neighbors. And rarely are these stories ever told.
My name is Carolina Vasquez Torres. I come from the Little Village area, so it's a predominant immigrant community. It's the second community of immigrants here in Chicago, the first being Pilsen. So it was great to be able to have this opportunity to show these stories to people who may not have that type of pleasure of hearing, mm-hmm. because I always find a pleasure in hearing these stories.
And hearing their own stories yeah. in that way. And I would assume in Little Village and Pilsen, but predominantly in Little Village, people being able to hear stories of others being undocumented or dreamers would mm-hmm. resonate, because I think that there's a large population in that area of Chicago
Definitely.
That are undocumented.
Yeah, I think these conversations are, they come up in parties, they come up in just social gatherings, and these are just stories that are very comfortable within the immigrant community, but it's a different story once you're sharing those stories outside of that community.
How do you get people to share their stories?
A lot of ensuring. I think that first things first, it's people who you know that you go to first, and knowing that the first step is being comfortable sharing it within their own community, and then telling them if you do not want your name shown, if you do not want your voice to be your own, if we can find a way to just hide your identity, that's also valid. And I think that's one of the things that I think, especially having my first interviewer not want her identity shown, mm-hmm. I had to really ensure her that her name was not going to be said, that she didn't really have to give any personal identification that would target her specifically, right. Because that's the fear, right? If I come up in public and I share who I am or what I went through, then I'm going to be immediately targeted by ICE.
That's what makes this series so special. We never get to hear from those personally affected by the policies being crafted in Washington, D.C. Not because the news media is biased, but because of the subjects. They don't want to be heard.
It's difficult to have the more difficult stories be told because of what these people are carrying within themselves, right? And it's harder for them to come forward and share this with a wider public that it does not. I guess one of the fears is my story going to be taken the way I want it to be taken, right? Because, again, it's always up to the audience. How are they going to perceive
right,
it,
right?
So I think that as a journalist, it's always, or as somebody who was interviewing all these different people, was my point going to get across, right? Or are all these other people going to understand the struggle, or we're just going to add it to the pile of stories that had already been told?
Another student reporter, Karina Vargas Camacho, was drawn to documentation for the personal stories, but also because she was sick and tired of the way the issue of immigration and immigration reform was being discussed.
You know, when you look at media, you know, popular media that's out there, and you look at immigration and undocumented, there is a persona or something that is made up, right? They, you know, they're stealing jobs, or there's all these things, allegations being said. And I was like, well, this is a great way where a partnership with Spanish Public Radio is giving us an opportunity to create our own media and to be able to tell a story of those that are go untold, or to shape that image that is being projected out there. And that for me was very important.
You see that as well. You see that there's a
Absolutely.
Stereotype and there's a caricature that is created when it comes to policy and politics
Definitely.
Around this issue.
Yeah, especially when there's lack of research, lack of knowledge, policy, has been going through a lot of things in the last like 4 to 5 years. Not a lot of people know exactly regulations. I didn't know myself. And then being involved in this project has shown me, and I've learned how things change within a matter of months.
The faculty advisor for documentation is Edie Rabinowitz, a longtime Chicago reporter and journalist who now is the acting chair and associate professor in the Department of Communication, Media, and Theater at Northeastern Illinois University.
A story that came to all of us naturally, and that I've been seeing with, honestly, Justin, in my office hours, is this what's happening to DACA recipients and Dreamers and, you know, undocumented students after the Trump became in power, or President Trump. And they were very scared, right? Would they be deported? And the just kind of general fear and the general sense of, why don't people want me in this country? I don't understand. I came when I was 3. I don't speak Spanish as fluently. You know, if I were dropped back in Mexico today, I couldn't survive, right? So, and then they also wanted to finish their academic careers, and it was very challenging. So I had seen these stories come through my classrooms, come through my office, and I thought, well, this could be really an opportunity to tell those stories, or to have students tell those stories.
And with some of the students coming out of the shadows is both for the subject of the story and for themselves personally. Take the case of Monse Gaitan. Monse is a Dreamer. She came to Chicago, undocumented, as a young girl. She sees this project as a way to tell her story as well.
It was something that I had been battling with since I was in high school. I come from a family that such a secret that people are so scared to talk about. And for my family to be okay with me saying I am undocumented, it was kind of scary, not only because of my family, but also because of the time that we're living in. Now, mm-hmm. There's still a lot of hate towards immigrants, and it was kind of difficult, but as I started doing a little bit pieces of really getting to know, and more than anything, I think working with students, working at schools made me realize that there's a lot of students who still are undocumented, who still need this hope, and they still believe that it's something to be ashamed of, or more than anything, to be scared of.
And as this podcast gets more and more attention, it hopefully will shed light on some of the obstacles these young subjects and journalists face every day. Again, faculty advisor Edie Rabinowitz.
You really feel for them. And that kind of question of am I going to be able to stay here and have this life that I've been having, that I've worked for all these years, and that I've, you know, I've learned the language, and I was at a disadvantage because I started without it, and maybe I was held back in elementary school, but I overcame, right? And the guidance counselors maybe at that point didn't know that I could even go to college, right? Or what caliber of college, even though I was on honor roll, I was doing all these activities. So some of these students and alumna have overcome continuously, and then they get to this point where they don't know that anything can come of it. They may be deported to a place where none of that matters.
Documentation can be heard on Spanish Public Radio, but the podcast is available wherever you get podcasts. There's an upcoming town hall at NEIU's El Centro campus next Thursday, April 11th, starts at 6:30. It will center around issues of employment and business, activism, and mental health. More to come here on Extension 720, including conversation about bilingual education and what will it take to teach our students multiple languages. That's coming up after the 7:30 news. It's Extension 720. Stay with us. Andrea Darlis, how are you? Are you recovered from election night?
I am, and I had so much fun. Our panelists were great, yeah. And it was just a good vibe, a good setting, and I hope we do that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
We do that again.
It was a lot of fun, too, because we got to sit right next to each other.
Yes,
you and I
did.
Are in different studios when we do Extension 720, but it was fun to be right next to each other and be able to kind of have that chemistry.
Right, and I'm stealing one of your panelists, too. Carrie Lester is going to be with me on the reporters
next
Monday.
Great. Perfect.
She's great.
It's Extension 720 here on WGN Radio with you till 10 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, very excited to bring Owen Keenan in studio. He's the author of Dugan's Bistro and The Legend of the Bearded Lady. It's a conversation about 1970s gay nightclubs in River North. It's very interesting to think about where Dugan's Bistro, 420 North Dearborn. So think about where that's at. That's next to the House of Blues. Many tourists and people in Chicago know that area very well and know it to be lined with Let Us Entertain You restaurants and other nightclubs for young professionals. Well, at a time in the 1970s, it was home to several gay nightclubs, including Dugan's Bistro, which was Chicago's Studio 54 years before Studio 54 even existed. So we'll have that conversation coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. As we continue our theme tonight, if we're going to understand each other, then maybe we need to understand each other. Bilingualism matters. That's the message being sent by a new Chicago project bringing together Chicago universities. The goal is to find ways for Chicago area schools to commit to teaching multiple languages. Over 2.5 million people in the Chicago area speak a language other than English. And even though CPS and other public schools have made strides to teach more English-Spanish dual language programs, there's still a need for more. We don't just live in a world that speaks the same language or even two of the same languages. Enter Bilingualism Matters, a national program looking to build a Chicago chapter. They've partnered with scientists and linguists at Northwestern, Loyola, UIC, DePaul, and the University of Chicago. So how do you teach more students and train more teachers to take on more than one or even two languages? In studio tonight, Kim Patowski, Spanish professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and Kara Morgan Short, interim associate director, School of Literatures, Cultural Studies, and Linguistics at UIC. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so why don't we start? Bilingualism Matters. What is this? I'll start with you, Kara. What is this? Give us an idea of where this comes from.
Sure. So this was an organization that was started in Edinburgh in the United Kingdom by Antonio Sarache as a way of outreaching to the community regarding research that's performed about bilingualism. So there's many researchers all over the world that do all sorts of research about bilingualism and language learning, and we decided that it's not enough for us to talk about that research among ourselves, mm-hmm. but we really need to outreach to the community, share information with the community that's relevant to different areas, to education, to health, to people's what they choose to speak at home. And so we formed this group, Bilingualism Matters, to start with that outreach.
It's amazing to me looking at this story and trying to get a better understanding of the culture surrounding linguists and scientists when it comes to bilingual education. There are a lot of myths that are surrounding this that you're trying to debunk with this. Kim, talk a little bit about what are the myths when it comes to bilingual education.
Right. It's very curious. We don't have an exact figure what percentage of the human population is bilingual or multilingual, but it's estimated about 65%. So the majority of the planet is bilingual or multilingual. But in this country, 80% of people say that they only speak English, and they kind of like it that way. I mean, you don't have to look very far to find cases of linguistic repression, linguistic bullying, etc., right? So I think that is due our sort of staunch monolingualism, at least two myths. One is that bilingualism will lead to societal problems. We're going to become a Tower of Babel, start to hate each other and fall apart, et cetera, which absolutely not true. Research indicates it's not true. And the other myth is that somehow we will damage individuals on some level. If I had a nickel for every pediatrician, teacher, people who should know better, well-meaning but should know better, who tell parents, oh, stop speaking Polish to your kids, stop speaking Korean, stop speaking Spanish, your child's going to become confused, your child's going to get left behind. It's absolutely not true. In fact, any quick glance over social media, at least on mine, seems like every week there's a new study showing how bilingualism is an advantage cognitively, socially, educationally, etc.
Is this the kind of thing where, because it, and looking at some of the research as well, there seems to be this idea to hang on to your indigenous language that many people in many different families may say, I'm going to hold on to this one. Maybe that's out of fear. I don't want to learn a new language, but this is the most important to me. So part of it, too, is trying to get people to move off of that spot, and especially English-speaking people who are like, you know one language, but it's time to learn another.
Well, I think if we're going to frame what you just said in terms of immigrant people who are coming here, that's absolutely not what we see. We don't see families who say, I'm here and I don't care about learning English.
Right.
No one knows better than them the need to learn English. They've suffered tremendously for the lack of English. In fact, what I see when I'm invited to parent groups, school districts who want to implement a dual language school program, the Anglophone families are all for it. It's the immigrant families who are very often scared. They say, I want my child to learn English. That's the most important thing. And when you show them the research that says, actually, if you want your child to learn English very, very well, what you need to do is educate them through their home language, and you'll see that the English comes in. And that's totally counterintuitive. I get it.
Yeah.
But that's what the research shows, and that's why Bilingualism Matters was formed, is to get this research out into the community so that parents can fight for their rights and say, no, I'm not going to switch the language I speak at home because somebody gave me bad information. Or, yes, I am going to choose a dual language program for my child. It will not confuse them. In fact, it will probably accelerate their English language acquisition and, as you just mentioned, help sort of cure my family's monolingualism.
You know, when we think about students, automatically we think about how you teach these kids. And, okay, maybe we're going to get in the spot where you need to learn or have dual language programs earlier on in their development. But it's also about the teachers. It's also about finding people who are right to teach these languages, not just Spanish, but other languages that are multilingual. So where do we find the teachers for this? I mean, because that seems to be one of the issues when it comes to resources.
Right. So so we need to create more teacher education programs that are focused on bilingual education and on second language learning. So, for example, at UIC, we do have a program where we train teachers to become language teachers. But that focus is mostly on teaching students who are English monolinguals to learn new languages.
In high school.
Whereas we need a much more comprehensive approach to preparing teachers to teach bilingual classes from very early on, like you mentioned, up and through high school, because we, the bilingual students in high school, they don't need to be in a traditional second language course being introduced to here's how you count in a new language and here's how you say the days of the week.
Right.
They already have that, so they really need a different approach in how they're taught to foster their own bilingualism to lead them to greater literacy and the ability to use that their own language more powerfully.
That's a great point. You don't think about that most of the way that I think about dual language or multi-language teachings is through rudimentary, meaning the beginnings, here's numbers, here's how you put sentences together. If somebody's already living a life where they're at dual language, that's not useful to them. They get lost in the shuffle, and they may not be looking to learn anything more. How do you, is it really about the framework of how we think about dual languages and multilingual education that we didn't start thinking more about the steps in which we teach this language?
Well, one of the outcomes of the myths that we mentioned before about this idea that somehow bilingualism is detrimental to children is that we start foreign language education way too late. If you're like me, you started probably learning Spanish or French when you were 14.
Right.
And you probably started by conjugating verbs and learning the colors and the numbers and the days of the week. That's too little, too late. Before No Child Left Behind was implemented, about a third of our elementary schools and three-fourths of our secondary schools taught foreign language classes. That's not a lot, but it's something. How well they taught it is a question open for consideration. After No Child Left Behind, those programs got decimated, and now you've got, it varies by state. I read that a national figure is only 18% of our kids, K through 8, are getting language education. New Jersey is the highest at 50. I believe Alabama was down towards the bottom. But if we really do want to have a bilingual populace, what we need to do is start in kindergarten and start by teaching half of the day in another language. There's no reason why any child should graduate from eighth grade monolingual.
You know, we stumble upon just a bigger idea of how you retrain the education system to take this on. Because when I think about fights over curriculum, they're always about what are the basic things that we're teaching our kids. And it may be reading, writing, arithmetic, that kind of, you know, arts gets in there, physical education gets in there. But there's always this tug, this push and pull about how much and how little and what is the mandatory minimum, really, when it comes to public schools having to give. So how do you convince state municipalities, state districts, other places like that, that this is important for the future of our kids when they're struggling to put meat on the bones, if you will?
Right. Well, I think you're absolutely right, and curricular fights are absolutely political fights. Whether you decide to teach evolution, whether you decide to teach sex ed, all these issues are extremely important and represent political ideologies. Language, too, represents a political ideology. And my sense is that it really goes against the grain of certain portions of society who don't want to see other languages, you know, sullying the United States. So I think it's up to those of us who have a different worldview who want to see more multilingualism. It's up to us, I think, from several different angles. It's got to come from the parents. I've seen school districts where parents are just banging on the doors to get dual language into their district. If you can get a superintendent, if you can get, and I will give a shout out to our new ISBE, Illinois State Board of Education director. She is a Latina who's very interested in dual language, so that can help. Local school boards, you have to try to come at this from a number of different angles. And here's the thing. You can still decide what you want to decide about curriculum. All we're saying is teach that curriculum, whatever it is you hashed out, in two languages.
Right. In studio tonight, that's Kim Patowski. She is a Spanish professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Karen Morgan Short is the interim associate director, the School of Literatures, Cultural Studies, and Linguistics at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Bilingualism Matters is what we're talking about. Bilingualism Matters Chicago. We'll take a quick break and come back, continue the conversation here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Talking about Bilingualism Matters, talking about dual language programs in schools tonight here on Extension 720. Kim Patowski is a Spanish professor at UIC, also Kara Morgan Short, interim associate director of the School of Literatures, Cultural Studies, and Linguistics at UIC. Bilingualism Matters Chicago is a new chapter of a national movement, but I'm fascinated because you said that you wanted to start the best policy or the best curriculum would be to start kids early, start them in kindergarten. And obviously that's not happening. It happens in some school districts. It may not be happening in others. Does the human brain, does it change the way that it takes on a new language as you get older? Can you learn more effectively at, say, age 5 than you could at age 25?
So the kind of research that I do speaks to this question really well. So we actually look at the brain and how the brain processes new languages when people are learning these languages past any purported critical period, so after they're 14 or after they're 18. And when you look at this neuroscience-based research, you actually find that the brain is really capable of learning language even in adulthood. We still have that capability. It doesn't drop out. Now, it's much harder, but not necessarily because our brains are really wired differently as adults than it is than they are when we're children. The way we're exposed to language is so different when we're adults. We might have a few hours of exposure to language where children have exposure to language all day, arguably, if they're in their you know, with their family. And we've done a study where we looked at different ways of training adults and have found that if you train them more in an immersion kind of context where they're listening to the language, they see what it means, they're not conjugating verbs, they're not studying vocabulary, but they're really immersed in how what this language expresses, their brains actually end up processing the language quite like a native speaker would, versus if you teach them more in a grammatical, traditional grammatical way, their brains are still capable, they can still learn the language, and we still see some neural processes that look like native speakers, but not the full spectrum that we see, the full spectrum of native speakers that was brought about by this kind of more immersion approach. So really being immersed and being immersed in the language in a real meaningful way seems to be important for language learning.
If I can jump in here, it's also true that language learning, I think, is driven by need, and a child needs to learn the language to get their needs met. I didn't start learning Spanish till I was 13, and, you know, not for nothing. My Spanish is pretty good, okay? So, yeah, your ability to learn does not decrease, and you talk about the processing ability remaining the same. Production does not. Production ability does not stay the same. If you've got three siblings who immigrate from China, one's 2, one's 10, and one's 15, I think we all know who's going to have an accent their whole life. They all might have the same cognitive ability to process their new language, but the productive ability, I think, is it's just arguably and demonstrably true that earlier is better. And when you're immersed in the language and you're getting that input for different reasons, you need it for to survive, basically. So it's not just the hours a day. Let's say you have a 6-year-old who's getting 6 hours of French a day, and then a 20-year-old who's getting 6 hours of French a day. The kind of French they're getting, same amount of time, is going to be very, very different. The 6-year-old's going to be much more concrete things. It's going to be getting their lunch. It's going to be things they need to do, whereas, you know, I'm not sure what that adult would be getting. So there's a lot of different factors that go into the different results that we see over and over and over when you compare older versus younger
languages. Are there harder languages than others to learn? Is it the kind of thing, rarely do I have linguists in the studio, but this idea that, you know, there might be, so you hear the German language, you're like, I'm not going to be able to pick that up, or Mandarin, where you're like, there's no way. Is that just our bias that's talking, or are there languages that are harder than others?
Some of that is bias, for sure, but the what was the Foreign Language Institute that did it? Somebody, maybe it was the Monterey, I think it was the Monterey group out in California that trains a lot of our military, I believe, in languages, came up with a 4-tiered scale. If you're a native English speaker, how difficult a different languages will be for you. And among the least number of hours required to gain basic proficiency, you had the Romance languages, and I believe... No, German was a little bit more. German was the second group. I believe the fourth group. Arabic was in there because I'm trying to learn some Arabic right now, and I'm the worst student in the class. Chinese, Mandarin was in there, Japanese, and I forget the ones sort of there in the middle. But yeah, there is some data suggesting that certain languages are more, those that are more typologically similar to English are going to be, require fewer hours to acquire. But then some people argue with that Foreign Service Institute scale as well.
You know, it's funny because there's been times, I feel like in the last decade, or even, it might even go administration by administration, where there seems to be more of an emphasis on one language or another. There was a time when we were talking about Mandarin. Everybody in America needs to learn Chinese and Japanese because that's going to be the business language of the future. We've heard, you know, obviously with Spanish is one that's this country is going to be speaking primarily Spanish, and at a certain point we need to be up, we get our students up on Spanish. Do we see through that? Is that just political talk, or is there some truth to the idea that these languages may be more important than others?
Yeah, I would say that that's more driven by what the government sees as the needs of the languages that we need for critical areas.
And businesses, too.
And yeah, and business as well. And they provide really nice scholarships, actually, critical language scholarships to have citizens go out into different parts of the world and learn these languages.
I think linguists in general try to remain agnostic about those kinds of questions. They're mm-hmm. important questions. And certainly if someone says, I want to learn a language that will be useful to me in my life, we certainly understand that. But the brain doesn't care if you're speaking Finnish or Basque or some language that has 12 speakers. The brain doesn't care. Bilingualism is absolutely good for the brain, and once you've got two languages down, you can more easily add a third. So any kind of language development, bilingual language development that you put in there is a good thing.
Bilingualism matters. Chicago, the new charter here in Chicago, and two of the principals here, Kim Patowski, is a Spanish professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and Kara Morgan Short, who's the interim associate director at the School of Literatures, Cultural Studies, and Linguistics at UIC. Much more to talk about. We're out of time, but I definitely want to have you guys back to continue this conversation about how we process language and how we teach and our kids' language, multilingual America. So thank you so much for being here, and good luck with Bilingualism Matters Chicago.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Andrea. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Picture River North. You know the area. Hubbard Street, sports bars, high-end restaurants, a playground for Chicago's young professionals. But if you were in the same neighborhood, say, in the mid-70s, you would see a different River North. It was a hotbed of gay culture and gay nightclubs. And since nobody lived down in this area, the gay community was free to be as loud and as proud as they wanted to. But it was the 70s in Chicago, and police raids and harassment were commonplace. A new book chronicles the time and this scene. It's called Dugan's Bistro and the Legend of the Bearded Lady. The Bearded Lady was a man dressed in drag, and it was a big Chicago celebrity. As he had his own stage shows, he showed up in the newspaper nightlife columns. He hobnobbed with other celebrities like Bette Midler and Diana Ross, a gay disco icon. The author of this book is Owen Keenan. Owen has written extensively about gay history in Chicago, and as he points out, Dugan's Bistro, with its flair, its intensity, and its lines around the block, was Chicago's Studio 54 3 years before Studio 54 ever existed. Owen Keenan, my guest in Extension 720. Owen, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This is, I am fascinated by this, because to think of the address, 420 North Dearborn Street, right outside the House mm-hmm. of Blues, which people know it now, and tourists in this area, the near north development, if you will, Loop Development, has turned this into an entirely different neighborhood, but it was different in the 70s.
Oh, sure. And the bistro was in no way an island. There were dozens of LGBT bars in the area. The Gold Coast was just up the street. I think the last holdout was probably the Baton, which just moved
a couple months ago, right? Why write about the bistro?
I really wanted to. I actually was working on another project. I've worked with Tracy Baim in writing bios of three different Chicago LGBT legends. Jim Flint, Chuck Renslow, and Vernita Gray. And it was when we were working on the Renslow book, we were talking about River North, because Chuck was the owner of the Gold Coast, and someone mentioned the bistro, and they mentioned the Bearded Lady, and they said the Bearded Lady was someone who you could not imagine what their day-to-day life must be like. And as soon as they said that to me, that was, you know, catnip. I immediately wanted that as my next
Well, let's
project.
Talk about the Bearded Lady. The Bistro, okay. of course, became, it was 9 years of just one of the more celebrated clubs in Chicago, lines around the block, and people, both gay and non-gay, coming in and really leaving their troubles at the door.
Yes. And that was one thing, truthfully, about the Bistro that was very interesting, in that it was one of the first places where straight people and out gay people mingled socially. But as long as the bistro was open, Eddie was adamant about the fact that it remain a gay club.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Bob Tice.
Okay.
Bob Tice is the Bearded Lady, and Bob was Bob in his regular life, and when he put on his different extravagant outfits to become the Bearded Lady, became a different persona. What do we know about Bob?
Lots. Actually, I think the focus of the book is when Bob comes to Chicago. Bob was a veteran. He went out to San Francisco and saw a little of the nightlife scene there. And he was particularly influenced by the Coquettes that were, especially Hibiscus, who was the head of the Coquettes, who basically had a beard and wore a dress. So Bob came back to Chicago. He sort of adapted that for the club scene.
And this was early 70s, right?
This is the early 70s.
Yeah.
And started going out to different clubs. This is 72. And ran into who would eventually be Eddie and Ron Veltman, who would be two of the original people at the bistro. Eddie, the owner.
Eddie Dugan, right?
Yes, yes. And when the bistro opened, they knew that the bearded lady was someone they wanted to have there. And they knew they could make Bialy Celeste.
And so he comes in, and not just, at first he makes entrances to the bar where, people are just thrown aback by his style and his and just flamboyancy, his layers. but then it comes and becomes a stage show. It becomes part of the act in the sense that at 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, there are different times, people were clamoring for him to get up on stage, and he performed.
The music would stop, the crowd would part, BL would come out on stage. A lot of times he would have his back to the crowd, which he called giving back to the community, is what he referred to that as. And what would be playing usually was Love's Theme by Barry White's Love Unlimited Orchestra. And he would have a hand fan, and he would slowly lower the hand fan and look over the crowd. And then it would segue into the Isley Brothers, Who's That Lady? And the crowd would start stomping their feet and shouting, Who's That Lady?
Hundreds of people.
Hundreds of people. And what would happen is BL was layered in an incredible amount of clothing. He'd be wearing a house dress, and he'd take off a house dress, and it would be another house dress, and then it would be gauchos in a peasant blouse, and then another house dress, and then a corset, and then just people were amazed at the amount of clothing and the amount of layers that he could put on his body. And with every layer he took off, the crowd would scream, and then BL would scream back at them. And so he's one of those rare acts that had the distinction of the music having to go back on to calm down the club crowd.
That's amazing to think about. And I also, out of this, BL became famous in the way that everyone who went to the bistro at the time got to see him and was completely blown away that he started showing up in the nightlife columns in the newspapers in the 70s. He started showing up at different events. He became a local celebrity.
He was a local celebrity. He showed up regularly in the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, as well as the gay papers, Chicago Magazine. When he arrived at the Chicago International Film Festival, Claudia Cassidy made an announcement that he was there, which put him over the moon. He showed up in Time Magazine, in Penthouse. It's kind of crazy.
It is. And, obviously, he, as I mentioned, he had two personas. He had Bob Tice, who he was during the day, and then BL, Bearded Lady, at night. And you talk in this book about the contrasts. And, he was a hoarder. He would hoard. He'd go to thrift stores during the day to find these different outfits. But he also, at a certain point, started to had friction with the club and friction with the owners and sort of took on that persona, the bearded lady persona, and became hard to work with.
They did part ways a couple times. And BL, for all his love of celebrity, that's actually what brought him back more than anything, is he loved the crowds at the bistro, and he knew that he wanted to continue doing that. And so he eventually comes back. But by then, he had become such a huge part of the nightlife. He's on the bistro matchbooks. He's on the sign above the door. He's on their business cards.
It's really... he really became synonymous with the bistro and into the way that he started to do other clubs and things like that. But he always, it always felt like he was part of the bistro.
That was his home.
It was his home. Owen Keenan, my guest, he's the author of Dugan's Bistro and The Legend of the Bearded Lady. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a quick break here and come back. Okay, and I want to talk about Eddie Dugan. I want to talk about the bistro.
All right.
Because to say that it's Studio 54 is kind of cheesy because Studio 54 is its own thing. But this was happening 3 years before Studio 54. So this wasn't a knockoff. If anything, you look at some of those New York clubs.
No, the Bistro pioneered this
stuff. So let's talk about the Bistro more with Owen Keenan in studio here at Extension 720. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN in studio with Owen Keenan. We're talking about gay club history here in Chicago, specifically in River North, which is where the home of Dugan's Bistro, which is affectionately known as Bistro. Dugan's Bistro and The Legend of the Bearded Lady is the latest book from Owen Keenan, who is a gay historian here in Chicago, as well as an author of other books. Owen, Eddie Dugan.
Okay.
This is... you know, we talked about Studio 54, but Eddie Dugan, what did he do? Talk about Bistro. Why the Bistro?
Eddie had an amazing ability to make sure everybody had a good time. He wanted decadence, outrageousness, and excitement. And he knew how to deliver it. Eddie would do things like coax a drag queen to get up on the bar and kick everybody's drinks off, kick the napkins off, kick the ashtrays off, and then Eddie would replace everyone's drink. But he knew that the next day, everyone would go to work or hang out with their friends and be talking about the crazy thing that happened at the bistro. And that became a huge part of his sort of free advertising. It's just this perception that anything can happen. So if you miss a night, you know, you might be missing something people talk about for weeks.
And it worked because lines were around the block at the bistro, and it didn't matter if it was weekends or weekdays. He was a master at finding out, you know, doing little specials on a Tuesday night, you know, dollar beer, or like you're talking about, things that might grab people's attention for the next night. But he was not only a club owner, but he felt like a club promoter in the way that he did things that weren't being done in Chicago.
Oh, sure. The lighting, the sound, the theme nights. The Bistro was doing so many things that were just cutting edge. And they're things that we take as just normal now for nightclub activity.
Now, the Chicago police paid close attention, and the Chicago police were in the River North area. There was
right across the street,
and but there's a long history of the Chicago police and the gay clubs in Chicago, harassment and raids, and just this overall persistent persecution of gay clubs and gay club owners in this way that is hard to fathom today. But it was something that was part of the issue with gay clubs and gay life in the 70s.
Oh, sure. That had died down quite a bit by the time the Bistro opened. But what was interesting is that dancing took on a whole new importance for the LGBT community, because dancing was something that, although it was legal for same-sex couples to dance for a few years in Chicago at the time, it was often interpreted by officers as lewd activity. And this could just be any type of same-sex couple dancing.
Right. They had a lot of leeway to say lewd activity and not be called on it, right?
Yes. So dancing took on this whole new feeling. You know, we had been closeted and beaten down for so long that the community was just ready to explode and have a great party. And the Bistro opened at just the right time, and a lot of other bars did, that sort of keyed into that euphoria of the community.
Now, the police may have had some they might have been accurate in some of their harassment, just for the fact that the drugs and the and some of the public lewd activity that was happening at the dance floor was unprecedented. But this, I don't want to paint it like the bistro was, everyone was having a kumbaya moment. There was a lot of things happening in the gay clubs of the 70s,
decadent.
Right?
It was very decadent, yes. Yeah. It was the 70s.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in this book, and it inevitably gets to the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s and the end of the bistro. And you would think, and you know the story of Studio 54, there's a documentary on Netflix about how the feds busted it and they could never really get the moment. But with Dugan's Bistro, it really was a changing of a neighborhood, a political move by the city of Chicago to develop the north part of the loop. And they considered the gay nightclubs of the Hubbard Street area to be expendable.
Oh, sure. It was clean up the neighborhood. Rents started to go, you know, out of control. The bistro lost their lease a year before their 10-year lease renewal. So the bistro actually closed on their 9th anniversary. And when the prices started to go up in the neighborhood, the writing was sort of on the wall.
Right. You know, there also is this idea that you know, AIDS played a role in the end of the gay nightclub experience, especially in this kind of decadent experience. Not necessarily that that it was a direct impact, but the feel of the gay community changed, that this idea of the celebration of coming out was replaced by fear.
Yes. A good example of that is after the bistro closed, Eddie already had, the wheels were already in motion to open up his follow-up club, which was Paradise, and that was at 2848 North Broadway. The difference, I think, between those two clubs is very clear, and they're just, the bistro closed in 82, Paradise opens in 83. And the difference is in that feeling of celebration is replaced by a feeling of fear. So you have a lot of the same partying and drugs going on, but it takes on a feeling more of desperation than celebration.
Right.
And just, the time literally changed overnight.
The last week of the bistro. Yes. is historic in gay history. they went on a week-long binge party and ended with one big huge party to end it all right before, I mean literally
2,000 people.
2,000 people. The Tribune says 2,000 people come out, what, a day or two before the actual wrecking ball takes the place down. There's something great about that, to feel about the celebration, the community, the unity, for 2,000 people to come out to celebrate the end of a nightclub.
Again, I think it's something people did not want to miss. They knew it was a part of history. They knew that it was something that would be outrageous, something to remember. And I think so many people saw the bistro as a huge part of their lives. That's the main thing I wanted to get across with this book, was just how important a lot of this history that doesn't seem momentous really is to people. You know, people recall dancing on the dance floor with the fake snow coming down and the fog covering the dance as the happiest time of their life. And just when you interview people, just to see that look come over their face, you know, it makes you feel good to think that's going to be down in print. That's something that will be remembered, and that's the kind of fragile history that just turns me on like nothing else.
The rumor, and it's in the book as well, is that when the wrecking ball took the bistro down at 420 North Dearborn, that poofs of glitter came out of the wreck, because maybe it was in the floors, maybe it was in the walls, maybe it was rigged that way. Is that true, that there was glitter all over the construction site?
I heard that on a couple accounts. A lot of the with this book, a lot of what I wrote about is people's memories, and that's one of the reasons why I called it the legend, Dugan's Bistro and the Legend of the Bearded Lady, because at some point the factual information of what actually happened, I think it pales compared to people's perception of what happened or the legend of it. So I don't know specifically if the glitter was there, but I love that the glitter was there.
You know, this when you talk about telling this history and you talk about how important or momentous it is, even if it's just the story of a nightclub, it is important because many of the characters in the book are not with us anymore. They died of AIDS. Some of the main, Eddie Dugan, club owners, DJs, other people throughout the Dugan's Bistro history are gone.
The nightclub scene was devastated.
So it is important because it's harder and harder to tell these stories of something that was important to an entire community.
I agree. It's I think it's also important, especially to connect with LGBTQ youth. I've had younger people talk to me and say, I'm glad I live today because, you know, before now there was the closet and then there was AIDS. And when I hear that, I think, well, you know, there was a lot of other stuff going on as well. And I think it's important that you connect with younger people in this kind of fun way. I think that's what makes them interesting and interested in history. And they can feel the legacy of fun because they can connect with it. You know, it's just LGBT people out having a good time.
All right. Finally, Bob Tice, the bearded lady, went on and performed in different places after the Bistro. Never really the same. Changed his act. Didn't change his act. Ended up moving to Japan with his lover. Mm-hmm. What happened to Bob?
Well, Bob, after 2 months, maybe 3 months after the Bistro closed, moved to Tokyo with his partner Jeff Bruce. Lived there for 2 years, came back and performed for a while at Coconuts, which was on North Broadway in Chicago. Went back to Tokyo, but when he was here that time, he got his degree in art history. And then goes back to Tokyo, performs a little bit, but is mainly supporting himself by teaching English as a second language. So then in 1993... he comes back to Chicago, gets his master's in English as a second language, and during that time, he also is starting to study more more art history. He starts collecting Asian art, and he starts making art. He becomes an artist. So what eventually happens to him is that he dies of a blood cancer in Tokyo, but by the time he dies, he's gone through this transformation of being a work of art, an artist,
art collector,
an art historian, all these different facets of him. But he died in 2003 at age 56, and it's one of the most poignant lines in the book for me is that he always said he was going to live to be 100, you know, and it just shows you, I don't know.
That can't always happen.
That
can't
always happen.
But you know what? I will say that the bearded lady will live in Chicago's memories over 100 years, you know, for what he meant to so many people in the 70s, entertaining people at places like the Bistro.
I hope so. I hope so. It's an important part of our history, and using BL as a sort of a vehicle for telling that larger story of the downtown glitter scene is important, too.
Owen Keenan's my guest. The book, Dugan's Bistro and the Legend of the Bearded Lady. Owen, I can't wait to talk to you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chicago, a city on the lake. A city made of neighborhoods. Neighborhoods that all went for Lori Lightfoot. But now that election is over, the issues facing the city can get the attention they deserve, right? Right. The runoff may be dry, but we're continuing our neighborhood tour because somebody has to. Tonight, let's go to Hermosa. The stretch of West Armitage, just east of Pulaski, is known by many different names. You could call it Hermosa, Humboldt Park, maybe even Logan Square. It's the near northwest side of the city. Hermosa has some famous claims. Walt Disney was born here, and Schwinn Bicycles as well. It's home to a vibrant Mexican-American community, a community that keeps getting pushed and pushed out. Logan Square is in full gentrification mode, and many fear that this stretch is next.
Politically, it's the first ward, and the 26th, and the 35th, and the 36th. You get it. It's been redistricted. But as aldermen and ward maps come and go, the community stays constant. So what's important up here? Well, if there's one person I can think of to talk community, it's my friend Lily B. She's a storyteller, one of the best in the city. Lily just had a huge article in The Reader about how she's diversifying the live lit scene. She grew up in this area, continues to call it home. We meet at the Churro Factory in the 3700 block of Armitage for some coffee and, well, a churro. In my case, maybe two. What do you call this neighborhood?
It depends on the realtor, right? I know that for me, it's Hermosa, Humboldt Park. I call it home. I mean, this is the West Side. You know, it's at the end of the day, it's the West Side of Chicago.
Right, right.
It's the non-gentrified yet side of Chicago, like West Side Chicago.
I was going to say, I mean, one of the hallmark issues in this area has been gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
Logan Squared has seen so much in the last 5 years. It's crazy, yeah. Even before that, but yeah. Last 5 years alone. Do you feel it here? You said so this is kind of, you don't feel it yet here.
Not yet.
What do you think of that gentrification?
You see, this is the thing for me. It's like, I don't mind people coming in. I do mind people being pushed out. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't mind people coming in and being like, I'm here to make a life with my family, and like, I'm here to like live in Chicago. But I do have a problem with people coming in and being like, well, y'all gotta go. Or looking at me like I'm the outsider in my own neighborhood. It's like an insult sometimes to be looked at like an outsider in the community and neighborhood you grew up. Like, I'm 40 years in this, you know, in this piece. So to be looked at like I don't belong here by people who've been here, you know, yeah, a hot minute, that's kind of unsettling and a little bit kind of like the nerve.
What are the issues in Hermosa, in Humboldt Park here? Would you put gentrification at the top of that list?
I would say that, yeah, displacement, like housing definitely is a thing about, you know, who gets to keep and own properties, gentrification, housing. Not so much what people think would be the issues. Like, I think people think it would be like crime and all, like, it ain't that, but that's what you would see, right? Because that's how you get people to gentrify, is you make it about what it's not.
Yeah.
And what it is, and it's also very individual to the person, I think, that lives here. Because you ask my landlord, for example, he's gonna tell you it's taxes, right? And you ask me and I'm just like, I want us to feel more like a community. Though the issue for me is that we're disconnected and I don't feel like neighborhoods are neighborhoods anymore. You know, it's just like people coming in and sticking to themselves in their own little boxes and not kind of getting to know each other, yeah, because it feels so temporary.
The West Side has always had the stereotype of it's just run amok with crime. That there is, you know, someone needs to come in there and I don't know how they're going to fix the West Side of Chicago. But hearing you talk about it, that's not how people who live here perceive it or live it.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think that comes from?
It comes from money. Like, real talk, it comes from, like, who's going to make some money or who's going to make a buck creating this fear over what's happening in these neighborhoods, and how do we manipulate or control that fear so that we can create a solution. You know, they create a whole campaign around fear, right? So it's like, if people are afraid, then we can come in and say this will make you less afraid, and being less afraid is what you want, right? Like, and then so let's build this beautiful building, or let's put in this business that will ward off the crime. But it's like, no, I mean, I've talked to friends who are anthropologists, and like, the crime don't go nowhere, like, drugs don't go anywhere, they just morph, you know? So just, it's money, right? Like, I think people looking to make some money off of the buildings that people bought super cheap back in the day,
yeah,
you know, and now can say like, oh, well, you know, we could turn this $187,000 building into a $3 million building.
Exactly.
You know, like, that's what that is. And I'm not down. Like, my landlord right now is fighting to keep his building, right? And I'm just like, does that mean I'm gonna go somewhere? He's like, I'm fighting, don't worry about it, like, I'm fighting, which I appreciate,
yeah,
you know, like, to hear. But I also am kind of like, who's helping you, who you got, who's got your back in this fight, right?
Do you feel that your elected officials in this area have your back? Do you feel like you have strong political clout when it comes to Hermosa and Humboldt Park?
So I'm in, I got a new guy, Spada, right? So, like, that's my new guy where I'm at. But they change, you know? They redistrict. They move the lines. Now it's this guy. Now it's this guy. And I'm just like, at this point, I don't trust any of them. And not that it's, like, their fault. It's that, oh, gosh. Like, you move the lines, and now I have to go somewhere else, you know? So the relationship I've created with you no longer exists. I got to go create a whole new relationship. And people get tired of that, you know? Like, think about it. Like, you don't want to keep making new friends all the time. Just, you know what I'm saying? Like, your boss changes every day, right? You'd have to, like, oh, now I got to get used to this.
Well, you know, we talked a little bit about it during this tour about when they do redistrict the lines, they change it up, it almost disenfranchises the people who live there because they don't know who to go to. They don't. It's almost on purpose where if you want to keep old power structures in place, keep switching the lines because then people just feel like, well, I don't know what to do, so I'll just sit
they
out.
They become, yeah, they just become like, oh, whatever, I don't care, whatever. It becomes a very whatever apathetic, just like, whatever. And that's the thing, like, when my landlord says I'm fighting to keep my building, that's what I think about. Like, who's helping you? Well, it's not Proco Joe anymore, right? Like, it's not him. It's now this, like,
somebody else, right?
Somebody else.
You know? You just had a great piece in The Reader about being changing the face of storytelling. You've been a longtime storyteller in town, but you do a lot of different mics and showcases here in Chicago. And a lot of that has to do with getting people of color and anybody who is marginalized to tell their story, to not let other people tell their story. Mm-hmm. Why is that important to you?
Oh, man. We talk about, because that's what's been happening. Like, if you look at the biggest of the biggest person talking about people, right, which is, I'm going to say, like, Trump right now is painting everyone with that brush, like, all Mexicans, all this, all that, right? And people are buying it. Because we're all, like, I'm not like every Mexican. I'm sorry to say that, but I'm not sorry. Because I consider myself, when people ask me what I am, I'm like, Chicagoan. You know, what's your background? Chicago. Like, it really is. Like, I didn't listen to music from Mexico. Like, I just didn't. I listened to Chicago house music growing up. You know, I grew up on the streets of this city. I have Mexicans that don't believe I'm Mexican until I start speaking Spanish and singing some songs I do know in Spanish, right? I don't have the same... I'm not the same. And we're not! Like, can we get over this idea that we are the same? We are all very unique individuals. We experience things very uniquely as people.
Politicians, especially national politicians, they're going to try to do that. Do you feel that Chicago does that? Do you think that Chicagoans do that?
Yes. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? We're the most segregated city in the world, probably. We are so like that. And we don't go outside of these places. Like, I know people from the west side won't go to the south side. I know people from the south side won't come to the west side. And guess why they won't come to each other? Because they think the other is crazy. Like, south side is crazy. West side is crazy. Y'all really? For real? Same with north and south.
You know, your job is as an artist, you're in a lot of different hoods doing a lot of different things, right? Is it getting better?
I feel because I've been out there 10 years and kind of been... I mean, I talk to producers. I tell my friends about it. I bring people all the time to shows that they might not feel comfortable. And I bring producers. I take producers to places they might not feel comfortable. Because it's not about going to support just storytelling shows. It's about going to support things in those communities, right? Like, go and visit a farmer's market in a neighborhood that's not your neighborhood. I have a friend named John, real quick, white guy John, who I met telling stories. And we've been doing this, like, exchange of culture. He's very affluent, I would say. And I'm not. But a week ago, he took me to Costco in Schaumburg and Shaw's Crab House, which I had never had, but it's delicious. It's ruined salmon for me, which is the worst thing he could have done. Shaw's is ruined salmon. I can't eat any other salmon but the one from Shaw's. John's going to have to take me again. But then I took him to, you know, Books Brunch and Botanicals. It's like a, in Humboldt Park, which is like a bunch of women of color got together and decided they were just going to put together a day of like, come buy some woke books on feminism and like heal your with crystals and lotions and buy some Jibaritos. And I had him buying like Jibaritos. He took a piece of artwork home. That's what we need to be doing. It's just like, hey friend, I know you don't live in my neighborhood, but I would like you to come and support this thing. And then you will find people for your events if you want different audiences. Like, because I'll go to a show and if I see an all-white audience, they're doing something wrong. Because that's not Chicago, right? It's not our city. It's not. Get on a train and you'll know that's not our city, right? So what's happening? And I think it's people, like I said in the very beginning, trapping themselves, putting themselves in these little bubbles, in these little rooms, in these little condos, in these little boxes, and not leaving and listening to the stories that are being told about us, about each other, on the screen, on the phone, through their media feeds. Like, no, get out there and experience some people, like some real people. IRL, greater than URL, I say all day.
Storyteller Lily B in Hermosa, Humboldt Park, maybe Logan Square. Continuing our neighborhood tour here on Extension 720.
Back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Priya Mohanty joins us to talk about her new television pilot called Phobia. It's part of Open TV. Open TV was the platform that brought you Brown Girls, which is now in development with HBO, Fatima Asghar, and Sam Bailey's project. And the newest season, they do it by cycles or seasons, and the new season, Phobia, F-O-B-I-A, FOB is fresh off the boat. Priya plays an Indian woman who just got to this country and is learning the ropes, gets an American roommate. Hilarity ensues. She's got a big screening tonight. She's also got a screening coming up at the Cultural Center next week. And I believe on the 10th, they release the pilot to the masses. So we're going to talk with Priya tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, the I Heart Halal Festival is coming back to Navy Pier. Last year was the inaugural festival to celebrate the halal lifestyle. I always thought halal was just about how you prepare meat in Muslim faith. And it's more about living clean and being socially conscious, not unlike all of the movements that are happening in every religion around the world right now. But we'll talk about the halal lifestyle. The I Heart Halal Festival, the inaugural festival was last year, and 17,000 people at Navy Pier. They're expanding it. The headliner, Lupe Fiasco. This is next weekend. So we'll have the organizers in for the Download in Chicago Business to talk about what you have to do to expand a festival when your first festival had 17,000 people. So we'll talk with them coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. So those two stories coming up. Quick programming note, I am going on no sleep and turning around, and I will be in for Steve Cochran tomorrow morning. The Steve Cochran Show, back to our old haunts, Pete. Now, they had asked Mary and Dave, Steve Grzanich and Mary Vandal, they said, is this a package deal? Does Pete Zimmerman come back? And I said yes, but you said no. That's just rude that you didn't want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And
I think it's very smart. Personally.
Well, actually, now that it's going to be let's go, go, go White Sox, it's like a thing now.
Yeah.
You know, just coming in here, you know, I was like, yeah, I don't want to wake up early again.
Because this is live at Guaranteed Rate, right? It's a whole
opener. That's whole opener show. Makes me want to get there.
I know, right? It's nice. A really great opportunity to be a part of the home opening broadcast. You know, the Cubs broadcast, it's another radio station goes up to the Wrigleyville Bars. Does the, you know, you get Yoxies. Mm-hmm. How many wings can you eat?
It's very fun. I mean, are you at the ballpark tomorrow?
We are, yeah.
Yeah,
you did it last year, right?
I did it last year.
What's it like? Yeah.
It's awesome. It's so much fun because you get to go. I was Well, Steve was in the booth, Steve and Dave were in the booth, so I went down on the field.
Oh, nice.
Which was very cool to see it just so pristine at opening day. And I found a couple. They got engaged. He was on the pitcher's mound, and his girlfriend had no idea. He was AJ Pierzynski's
brother-in-law. Yeah. Right.
And they proposed, and she just started crying, and I'm watching this transpire, and I went, oh my God, you guys need to be on the air with us. And they just had such a great story, and she said she knew something was weird, and why would she have to go with them? And, you know, it's 6:30 in the morning, and it was just a very cute story.
That's great. Well, hopefully something like that happens. Or at least they let me shag a couple fly balls.
Yeah.
Right? Do they let you do that?
I don't think so.
What have they got to lose?
They let you walk on the grass behind the velvet ropes. Yeah. But you can't really go near the pitcher's mound.
They're not going to let me steal second base and show how I slide head first?
I don't think so.
No. Okay.
You go rogue.
I could go rogue.
Just go for it.
There you go.
Shirtless, though. It's White Sox Park.
Do some sliding, like the Lagoos.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's true.
But very funny.
Yeah. So So Steve's out tomorrow. So I'm in for him. So I think I'll be up in the booth with Dave. Lots of great White Sox stuff coming up tomorrow. A White Sox themed home opener broadcast here on WGN Radio. Steve Cochran Show, hosted by me, Justin Kaufman.
I say go rogue.
And I may go rogue. Or at least shirtless. At least shirtless. Even if it's in the booth, just with Dave.
I go with rogue. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rogue or shirtless?
Yeah, I go with rogue.
Yeah.
Rogue. You know, we can interpret it any which way, but right. I interpret rogue as shirtless. Without a shirt.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It is
the
cell.
That's coming up. So that'll be on tomorrow morning starting at 6 a.m. So that's coming up. So yeah, and then next week we're on the air Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I'm not sure. Andre, are you doing the reporter show on Monday?
Yes, I have the reporter show on Monday, and then you guys will be on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we're preempted for
a little bit
too because of the Sox have a bunch of night games coming up.
That's the thing. Early in the season, they do a lot of day games because of the weather. They want to keep the sun up as long as possible. But once they feel they're out of the woods, it becomes night game central for baseball, which I like. I mean, I don't like it because it preempts us to do this wonderful show, but I like as a fan because I like the nighttime stuff better than the daytime stuff.
I have some Cubs tickets coming up, and I have two games, April 11th and the 14th, was what I ended up with in our draft.
Mm.
Yeah,
early.
I kind of moved those. Molly's parents luckily took those off our hands. Yeah, we'll go to a Cubs night game on April 11th.
Right. Bundle up.
Bundle up.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is a segment where we talk to business leaders who share their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, we're getting closer and closer to festival season in Chicago, so let's talk about what it takes to run one. From street festivals to music festivals downtown, it's quite an undertaking to produce, market, and maintain a Chicago festival. It's the second year for the iHeart Halal Festival. It'll be at Navy Pier coming up on the 12th through the 14th. Last year, the inaugural festival that celebrates a halal lifestyle brought over 17,000 people to the pier. This year, the festival is expected to be even bigger with the announcement that hip-hop star Lupe Fiasco will headline. Also, music from Brother Ali, who will be on the program next week, and stand-up comedians. But that's just part of it. You also have food demos and panels about Muslims and the media. In studio with me on Extension 720 tonight, co-organizers Salman Chaudhry and Asma Ahad. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, so first of all, I love everything about the festival, and I'm one of these people because I'm reading all about this. I was always under the impression that halal was just about food, and it's much more than that.
Yeah, it is a lot more than just food. When we were sort of developing this festival, we wanted to have a conversation around sort of the values associated with halal, and not only as it pertains to food, but across the entire spectrum of how you live your life. The clothes you wear, where you invest, where you travel, you know, all of it is sort of based and rooted in these values that we have, these core beliefs that are, you know, based on compassion and being ethical and socially conscious. So those are the elements that we sort of wanted to like highlight in the festival and sort of bring awareness to even how halal exists within the Muslim community and how it's a sort of connection point for people outside of the community to get a better understanding of Muslims.
I've done a lot of different stories, and I have always known that just to be about preparing the meat. Mm-hmm. Is that just an issue with Americans, that non-Muslim Americans who just don't want to know more about the what halal stands for? Or is that just misinformation from the media?
I think a lot of times, even within Muslim culture, a lot of people attribute halal to food. But as Salman and I were researching the concept of this festival, one of the things that we learned was that a lot of millennials, and they call it the Generation M, really associate halal with lifestyle and everything that's good and everything that's sustainable. And that's a value that not just Muslims, but everybody else could get behind as well.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at it and you state it out the way you just did, you recognize that this is much not even about religion. This is about a movement among human beings,
exactly,
to live a different way or live a cleaner lifestyle.
Right. The common denominator between every spiritual and religious framework is compassion, right? You know, we use halal to show we're compassionate, right? And what we eat, how we treat the animal before we, when we raise it and when we slaughter it for nourishment, and in every other aspect of our life. And everyone has these core beliefs of being compassionate. So for other people to, learn about us through halal, I think, is what we're trying to do here.
What can people expect from the I Heart Halal Festival?
They can expect to be amazed because there's so much great programming, and we're bringing people from all over. Last year, I know you mentioned we had over 17,000 people, but we also had people from over 33 states. People came from Canada. We even met a couple of people from abroad. I think I met a couple from South Africa last year. So we had people from all over come to our event. And this year, we've expanded our footprint. We have a larger bazaar. We have expanded programming. Last year, we had a comedy show, which was a huge hit. And this year, we're expanding that by adding a hip-hop concert. And, Lupe Fiasco is a headliner. We also have Brother Ali performing. And what's great about these artists is they have such a positive message, and that really resonates with not just your traditional halal mm-hmm. consumers, but with the broader population.
And it really does shine a light on the Muslim American community here in Chicago, which is huge, mm-hmm. and a lot of times gets overlooked.
It does, absolutely. And, we wanted to create a festival that was really something that the community could get behind, but also create a festival that gave other people outside of the community a way to make more meaningful connections with the Muslim community and learn about them through our food and our culture and our artists and our speakers. We have, personalities in the media, through all the programming, we're trying to showcase all of that.
Well, as we mentioned, this is the Download in Chicago business, and, mm-hmm. and I want to talk to you guys about throwing a festival, because as someone who has dabbled around the edges of wanting to put mm-hmm. a festival on, it's a lot of work. There's a lot that goes into the location, the permits, the licensing, the right. vendors. What drew you to the idea of a festival? Now, beyond just celebrating the halal lifestyle, just the organization of putting a festival together.
We noticed there was a huge gap. There's nothing in North America that comes close to what we're trying to accomplish here. And there is a real gap for us to create a platform that gives voice to this consumer.
I've worked in the events industry for a long time for most of my career, mm-hmm. but never in the production standpoint. I was always front of the house working with the technology part. So this was my first stab at, trying to build it from the ground up, which has had its own challenges with, you have to be super organized. And I think that's been a bit of a challenge, just, still trying to stay organized. And,
because it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to do a festival and 17,000 people are going to come to that festival. But there's also the vendors, there's the panels, there's, as you mentioned, the comedians this year, musicians.
To be honest, our metric last year was 5,000. So we, we learned from that we need to expand beyond what we had last year, because we kind of blew that away.
What? Let's go back to that. If your metric is, okay, we're expecting 5,000 people and 17,000 show up, as organizers, how do you handle that? How do you deal with much more success than you intended?
I don't know. You just roll with it. I mean, one funny part of it, I, planned out this whole floor plan. And a lot of it, the design stuff, was just based on other shows that I worked on, like the Beautiful Element. So I wanted to create a really beautiful show. The one thing I forgot about was strollers. And the kids' zone was right by the entrance. So all the strollers are parked in this beautiful entrance we created. And I'm like, oh, God, I need to have dedicated stroller parking.
Always, man. You always got to think of the stroller parking. From beyond just stroller parking, which I'm sure you thought about. This year, don't you have to think about more?
We do.
Yeah, how do you expand?
So we expanded our partnership. So, we can't do it alone. And Let Us Entertain You came on. Let Us Entertain You at the Pier came on as a partner. And they're going to be bringing four restaurants and two the festival hall, and also three of the restaurants downstairs are going to be going home.
I was going to say, this becomes, when you're running a festival, and I think people have this idea that, especially when it comes to Chicago festivals, maybe street festivals, or other, that when they get close, they start to work on this, and you know, they got to get the sawhorses out to block off the areas. But this is a full-time job. This is a job that is 365 days, because as you look to expand, as you just mentioned, you have to start thinking about approaching other partners.
Absolutely.
And creating more opportunity for your festival, especially in the off season, in the months that the festival's not on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even like with the food, like last year, it ran out. You know, there was long lines, so we had to through the partnerships, like Asma just mentioned. You know, we're you know, making sure that we have enough food there for everyone that we're expecting,
and we also expanded our space. So yeah, last year, like, it was so crowded, like everybody was eating or standing or sitting wherever they could find a spot, and so this year we expanded the food space to have a large food hall where people could sit and eat. So it's also looking at that space as well.
To do this in Chicago, to do it at Navy Pier, as you mentioned, you've found a gap in when it comes to these kind of festivals, any sort of halal festival in North America. Mm-hmm. Why Chicago? What is it about Chicago that it makes home for the iHeart Halal Festival?
I mean, one, it's home for us, and that's the main thing. But it's also, you know, one of the most diverse Muslim populations exists within Chicago and also the Midwest. And it's also just centrally located in the country. So it's easier just for everyone to get to. And also doing it at Navy Pier was important because it's such an iconic destination. It's not only in the city, but worldwide. It's one of the top 50 tourist destinations. And they've been so accommodating with our needs, knowing that we have dietary restrictions. Like, we're celebrating halal, so we have to be able to showcase halal food. So right. They've been very accommodating with that. And, you know, it's easy for people within the community that live here that, you know, need to rely on public transportation, for example. They can easily get
to it. They can get to it, centrally located.
Yeah.
My last question to you guys is, you know, as you put this together and you celebrate halal, what's it mean to you to have a successful festival? To think at the beginning of this, when you were doing it last year before it started, whether or not people are going to accept this, and now to be in its second year and have Lupe Fiasco headlining and getting all of this press, what's it mean to you as co-organizers of this festival to have this meteoric success?
To me, it's personally rewarding because not only do I feel really strongly about our mission and what we're doing, but we're also gaining so many valuable partnerships. Everyone wants to now like work with us because they see what we're doing. And these are just really amazing groups and different organizations and civic leaders and, you know, corporate leaders that want to work with us because they see value in our mission and what we're trying to do. So I think for me, that's what's most personally rewarding.
It gives, like we said earlier, it just gives voice in a positive light to a consumer. I think that's always, like, you're controlling the narrative around the story of who the halal consumer is and what our halal values and how everybody could come together with this community to build a bigger community.
The festival is called the iHeart Halal Festival. It's at Navy Pier coming up on April 12th through the 14th. In studio with me tonight, co-organizers Salman Chaudhry and Asma Ahad. Thanks so much for coming in, talking about the festival, and good luck next weekend.
Thank you.
Coming up, Phobia is the new pilot from Priya Mohanty. It's going to be on Open TV. She's at the MCA tonight. They're doing a screening of it. They got another one at the Cultural Center coming up on the 9th. And then I believe on the 10th, they make the pilot Phobia available to the public. It's a comedy from the Chicago writer and creator and actress. Phobia, F-O-B-I-A, and F-O-B is fresh off the boat. That's the shorthand for fresh off the boat. And it's a story about a Indian woman like Priya who came to this country fresh off the boat and had to adjust and assimilate, if you will. Got an African-American roommate, and hilarity ensues as they find out that they're not that different after all. That's the pilot's great. It's well done. It's shot here in Chicago actors, and she's a creator, writer, and the star. She plays the lead role, Kay. So that'll be coming up in the 9:30 segment to talk with Priya about her new show, Phobia. Interesting. You know, we go back to the election from Tuesday night. Marilyn Katz told me this, and she's kind of sussing this out. Marilyn, a longtime political activist in town and strategist, and she worked with Harold Washington. But she sent me a breakdown of the numbers, which not a lot of people are talking about. And we kind of noticed this as well. But when you have I think it ended up being less than 30% turnout for the election. So if when you're talking about the mayor-elect and Lori Lightfoot and the new aldermen and the old ones, that yes, you could celebrate now that the change is in the air and that they won their respective elections. But there has to be some concern that 71% of Chicagoans stayed home. And I know that, that always gets echoed and always that sentiment is thrown out a lot, saying, well, the voter turnout was so low, you know, you didn't everyone. But did you know from this article that Maryland sent that 71% staying home was the most since 1951 in Chicago
history? That's terrible.
It also says that this momentous moment in Chicago election history may not be as momentous as advertised, meaning if 71% of Chicagoans stayed home, the most since 1951, how much of a movement for hope and change and reform was there? And that's something that I think that the new city council and the new mayor will have to grapple with as they represent 100% of Chicago and 71% that didn't want anything to do with the choices that were on the ballot.
You know, it's unfortunate, too. It's never been easier to vote. There are so many opportunities. Early voting is opening now earlier than it ever has been. There's voting sites all over the city.
Yeah, what does it
say? You could do it by mail.
What is? I mean, it's obvious that they have done. I mean, the early voting has changed the way that we vote. Everyone can. There really are no excuses. It's not a crisis in convenience.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with something deeper, and a deeper disengagement or disenfranchising, if you will, of Chicago voters.
And I also think, too, Justin, is that there was a couple of people we both know who said, oh, well, Lightfoot was going to run away with it. You know,
right.
I didn't feel the need to vote.
And there's got to be some of that. And then there has to be the overwhelming feel that their vote doesn't count, or they never vote and they're not engaged in being disengaged, if that makes sense.
Do you think it's laziness?
I wonder, you know, you see the number. There's such a huge population of younger Chicagoans. If you think of people from 18 to 35. Right?
Yeah.
And think about all the people who live in Chicago, go to school somewhere else, maybe in the Big Ten, and they come to Chicago. Or maybe they grew up here and they went through CPS. I'm not sure that they think about voting. I'm not sure they are thinking that the issues of their local municipality are important for them to be involved in.
Yeah.
Now, obviously people harp on it and harp on it and harp on it, but there may be more of I kind of think of myself, and I'm not, I did vote when I moved to Chicago. When I went to Columbia College and I moved and my residency was here, it was early 90s, mm-hmm. right? So the first election I could vote in would be 1995, and it was Mayor Daley versus Joe Gardner, right? I remember voting for that, but I also know that I was already an intern at a radio station, and I covered that election night, so I was more engaged than I think my roommates at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think my roommates cared that there was an election with Mayor Daley. You know, I don't think that was something that you process when you're 19, 20 years old, and I just wonder how much that really, you don't start to make a transition to saying that it's important to you until you're having to pay taxes or own property or be more involved as a citizen in the community that you live.
And we saw from these aldermanic races that really every vote does count.
Yeah.
I mean, there are 20 votes separating some of these candidates.
Mm.
My wife went to early votes. This is speaking on your maybe young people don't care. They're studying. This is not on their radar. She went into early vote. We went the day before, and she said there was a kid there, and then the kid asked somebody if the election that they were voting for today is the same one as the one on Tuesday.
Hmm. There you go.
Like, had no idea what it was all about.
Talk about disengaged.
Yeah, and I have to give credit to, I do think, and I know people, you know, would disagree with me, but I do think it was good for the election to have Chance the Rapper get involved and try to bring out that vote. And it didn't happen, but the attempt to bring out that vote was noble in the way that to say, engage young people, engage. Now, I also don't want to act as if the only marginalized community in Chicago is a younger voter. there are a lot of adults, as we know, Andrea, that, mm-hmm. that said, nah, I don't really need to vote in this. Absolutely. My vote doesn't matter. So I don't want to pin this huge number, this historic number of people who stayed home on 19-year-olds living in Wrigleyville. I don't want that to be the case. But there's something amiss. I don't know what it is. It could be uninspiring candidates in the way that they didn't think that the candidate could be, like you said, they know one candidate's going to win, so what's the point? And it also could mean something bigger where it's just disenfranchised, where they don't feel like they are heard and respected, and they don't feel like their vote matters when it comes to the issues of Chicago. I don't know.
Here's something else, too. Do you guys think that it has to do with how you're raised? I mean, my dad, both my parents were kind of news junkies, and we were always reading the paper and talking about things like that. But then I have cousins who, to this day, and they're in their 40s and 50s, they just don't vote because they don't care.
I think you hit on something there.
Like, I think it's just maybe how you're raised with voting and the importance of political science. I never even took a in my high school, I went to high school at Andrew High School in Tinley Park, and we didn't have political science.
Right.
We didn't, and now I know they do.
Oh, that's good.
So.
Yeah, I don't think we did either, although I was a representative in my 7th grade class or 8th grade class for student council, and I ended up getting impeached.
Get out. Are you serious?
I'm serious.
What did you do? Well, wait, do we want to know?
No, it wasn't anything scandalous.
Okay.
It was
you got impeached.
The class wanted to vote one way, and as the representative, I voted another, and I forgot what the issue was. It was, something with the cafeteria or something, which is, that's how you do things.
Tacos every day.
Yeah, and the 8th grade teacher who was big in the poli-sci, and the 8th grade teacher wanted to make a moment out of this to say that your representative did not vote the way you wanted to, class. What do you want to do?
Oh,
and so they went through the whole proceedings, and they impeached me, which was, I blame it on Timmy Wright. I think he was stoking the flames of the class. It was his clicks.
Clicks.
It was clicks.
Oh, yeah. And what was his 8th grade?
7th or 8th grade.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was political. It was a political witch hunt.
See, I was my class president in 8th grade, and I didn't experience that. Yeah, no, see. I was vice president in 7th grade, and I wanted to run for vice president in 8th grade. And then the guy who was we were like on a ticket together. I had a big crush on this guy, and he ended up not running, so I thought, I'll run for president.
Yeah, and you won, and then you served your constituents in a good way. You did not get impeached like me.
Right, and he's, we're still friends to this day, and he's a successful, famous musician now, so he should have run.
Jim Peterick?
No, is it Jim Peterick? You know what it is? You guys know him? It's Bruce Lamont, who is the lead singer for Led Zeppelin, too.
Oh, there you go. Well, there, hey.
I know.
Any relation to Gene Lamont?
The former White Sox manager.
Maybe. I don't know.
All right. Let's take a break, come back, and we'll get the news with Andrea Darlis, former president Andrea Darlis.
Ah, yes.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on the 10th, Open TV will introduce their new season or cycle of pilots. Open TV is a web TV platform that focuses on giving voice to underrepresented artistic perspectives and experiences, namely queer, trans, women, and artists of color. They're probably most known for introducing us to Brown Girls, the series created by Fatima Asghar and Sam Bailey. Brown Girls is now in development at HBO. This year, there are several new pilots, including the one created by my next guest. It's called Phobia. It's spelled F-O-B, Phobia, as in fresh off the boat. It follows an Indian woman adapting to life in America. She gets an American roommate, and mayhem ensues. The writer, creator, and star of Phobia is Priya Mohanty, and she is with me in studio tonight on Extension 720. Priya, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Justin.
So where does Phobia come from?
Phobia is a riff on like P-H-O-B-I-A, Phobia, but also fresh off the boat. And I created the term to kind of encapsulate all the fears that immigrants go through as you're going through this life-changing transition of adapting to a whole new land and culture. And so for me, the term is something that I feel a lot of immigrants go through. It's kind of funny and comedic. Some of these things are kind of crazy and silly, like trying to you drive on the right side of the road, getting the dates mixed up because we say it differently. But then there are also bigger challenges that we're constantly, like, always living under the threat of, like visa restrictions and work permits, and some of which I experienced right. even as I was making the show, right? So that's essentially what I was trying to do with the show.
There is something to be said, because you say in some of the interviews this idea that, you know, coming to America is really about trying to live that American dream, or mm-hmm. try to live your dreams. And there are a lot of things that stand in the way of immigrants being able to do that.
That is absolutely right. And I feel like that's the juxtaposition and the irony of the American dream, because, yes, I think a lot of people come to America for that American dream, whatever that might be. It's different for different people. But then you also have all these hurdles that don't let you get there. For example, even while I was making the series, there were grants that were not available to me because I'm not a citizen. Mm. I am also right now, you know, under this looming threat of my work permit possibly getting revoked because of certain issues that are going on right now. So, you know, there's just different things. There's this uncertainty that you live with, and that can definitely get in the way of fulfilling that American dream.
So a lot of the issues that you take on in this, which is essentially a sitcom, it's a pilot, but it's a comedy. Mm-hmm. Where do you find the inspiration for, or are you using this as an outlet to talk about the things that are important to you or that are happening to you in your real life?
Oh, absolutely. I've been in America for almost 10 years now. I came in 2008. And so I have a decade worth of experiences to talk about in the show. So hopefully, you know, we get picked up and we can make seasons of this. But absolutely, I think the inspiration was to shed light on the challenges that immigrants go through, which a lot of people are oblivious to, which I think there are aspects of immigrant life that Americans can take for granted. The fact that, you know, tomorrow you might have to leave the country, like, in a day without a moment's notice. Like, for example, a lot of Indian immigrants, the wait time for our green card is anywhere between 60 to 200 years right now. So it potentially means that I could live the rest of my life as an immigrant without ever becoming a citizen. So no matter what I do, right? So there are lots of aspects of immigrant life that people are oblivious
to. Or we get stuck in the stereotype of what we think we know from it being a news story, or what we see on the nightly news.
Absolutely.
Like that.
And it's interesting to me because I feel there is so much talk about immigration in America, but we don't often hear from immigrants. We hear about immigrants, but we don't hear their perspective. Like, even a lot of the shows, they're usually from the first generation immigrant descendant perspective, as opposed to the immigrant perspective. It's about the parents. And I also felt the need to kind of update that perspective of what immigrants are and who they are and what they look like, what they sound like, a lot of those things too. So,
well, yeah. I always think about it too, because we've had other actors on and creators on this, on WGN over the years, talking about how underrepresented some of the stories of people of color are, specifically the immigrant experience, and how Hollywood goes too far in typecasting people, brown people, people of color. But in this case, this is even further than dealing with the issues of being someone with brown skin in America. This has to go to the whole idea of the immigrant diaspora, that this concept of living a temporary life. So it's not necessarily just a pushback to the norms that are happening in Hollywood or in America, but almost how the audience views immigration.
That is right, because I feel like even within my very well-meaning circle of friends, there are a lot of misconceptions. And I think the biggest thing for me is there is a tendency to homogenize the immigrant experience. And that's something that I also wanted to push back against with the show. It was a very deliberate choice for me to have two Indian immigrant women in the show, because they're very different.
Right.
They're from the same country and even the same city, but because they are different human beings who come from different backgrounds and different places, their experience of being an immigrant in America is going to be very, very different.
That's a great point. As a creator, how important is it to create juxtaposition or to create different or contrast when it comes to people of the same background or the same point of view?
Yeah, I think that was also the reason why I set the pilot, or at least the first season of it, in business school. That's how I came to America. I came to America to go to business school. And a lot of graduate schools in America tend to be really diverse. They have a lot of international student population. My school was 40% international students. Most of them were fresh off the boat like me. So we had people from China and Korea and Mexico and Portugal and Spain and Brazil, just from all over the world. And obviously, culturally, everyone's experience as an immigrant was very, very different. And how we interacted with each other was very, very different. And so my hope for Phobia is that we can develop it as a platform for varied immigrant experiences, and not just the South Asian immigrant experience.
Right, right.
Because it's different for everyone.
And I would think that, I mean, the fun part of this pilot is it is a comedy. So there's a lot that goes into sharing your story and how you've adapted to American life. But another big part of it is you have an American roommate. And that's important as well, that there's even this hesitancy at the beginning to be like, how can I live with an American woman? We're not the same. We don't know. But that's where all of the, not just the comedy, but the humanity comes from. The idea that you may not be as different as you thought.
That is absolutely what I'm going for, is that I think when we scratch the surface, below it, you see that we have so much more in common than we think. And it was interesting because, you know, when I was doing readings of the script, and even when we were shooting it, there were points when different people told me, oh my God, you know, that seems so American. And I'm like, that's interesting, because I wasn't writing from an American perspective. I was telling my truth. But it's great that you think it's American, because that just proves that there is universality in specificity. You know, the more specific we get with our experiences, the more we realize that they're actually more universal than we think.
Yeah, right. What would be the ultimate goal for the show? For Phobia, is the goal to get picked up and follow the same path that Brown Girls did and get mainstream America to turn it into from a web series to a sitcom?
So my main goal with Phobia was to humanize the immigrant experience, right? To, like, in the midst of all these conversations about immigrants and, you know, treating them as data and figures and statistics about how they're good for the economy or whatever, we tend to forget that they're actual human beings with, you know, their own hopes and dreams and desires. And so, yes, my big goal was to humanize the immigrant experience. And so, obviously, keeping that goal in mind, the more people we can reach, the more we can normalize it, the better it would be. So my hope would absolutely be that we can, you know, create seasons of this and reach out to a wider audience and showcase the immigrant lifestyle. And again, the relatability of it,
yeah, right?
That these are human beings as well. You know, you can be friends with them. We are just like you. So that definitely is something that I would be hoping for.
Okay, so my last question for you is just as the writer and creator and star of Phobia, when you put on stage your experience, your story, how different is the character Kay, right?
Yeah.
How different is Kay from Priya?
Well, I mean, there are aspects of her that are similar to me. There are aspects of her that I wish I had. I think of Kay as being a little bit of a brown Leslie Knope, really. I love Leslie Knope. I love how
Parks
passionate
and Recreation,
she is.
Right?
Yeah. I love how passionate she is. I mean, hopefully, as if we get to make the rest of the episodes in the season, what we will find out about Kay is that she comes from a very privileged background in India, but she's extremely passionate about her big cause is the environment. She really wants to, like, change the world, and she's passionate about things, she's loving. So there are definitely aspects of Kay that I aspire to. But in terms of, like, maybe similarities and backgrounds and the place that we come from in India, that's where we are probably similar.
Yeah, right.
And that's what I wanted to also talk about, is both Kay and me, I think we came to America to, you know, forgive the cliche, but find ourselves, I guess. You know, for, like I mentioned, like, different people come to America for different reasons, right? Some people come for, like, a good job, a good opportunity. And for me, it was to be able to find my own path, to be able to break away from some of the stereotypes of, like, oh, engineering and MBA, which I absolutely did, but I also wanted to find myself.
For some of the hardships that are in and made comedic in the show, are you on that path? Do you feel like you're finding yourself through this, through Phobia, through the work that you're doing here in Chicago? Do you feel like you're finding yourself?
I think I'm on a really good path to finding myself. I mean, like I just mentioned, up until recently, I was actually a walking stereotype. Had my engineering degree, did the IT job, got my MBA, did the corporate gig, and then I accidentally stumbled into acting, right? And for me, that's the gift that I've gotten of being in America, is being free from a lot of the societal expectations that might have prevented me from exploring this different path if I was back home in India. So that to me is the path that I've taken, is like, you know, figuring out my own passion in life and giving voice to my own hopes and dreams and desires, which is what Kay is doing too.
The writer, creator, and star of Phobia is here, Priya Mohanty. You can see the pilots that are, they're going to be released on the 10th, which is a big deal for Open TV. You can find that online. And there's also a showcase tonight at the MCA, but there's also a showcase at the Cultural Center coming up as well on the 9th. The show Phobia, F-O-B-I-A, and the writer, creator, star, Priya Mohanty, here tonight on Extension 720. Priya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Baseball. Home opener for the White Sox tomorrow. It's the Seattle Mariners. And then the Cubs have their home opener on Monday against, I don't know, the Planet. Pete probably knows. I don't know. Playing somebody. They got walloped again tonight. Cubs are off to a tough start for a team with high expectations and a lot of questions about their chemistry. For some reason, the management there decided to, in the offseason, to go down and talk to the players in their homes about eating better, no more fast food on the airplanes.
And, did they do that?
Yeah. I this story popped out. The Athletic had it right at the beginning of the season that Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer, they went down to different players' houses to talk about changing the way they approach the game, the focus and discipline. So no more fast food, no more alcohol on the planes, no more, and then a mandatory batting practice, I think, was a big part of that. Something like that. Anyway, it was this weird thing to do right at the, to be released at least at the beginning of the season. And there were questions about whether or not that undermined the coach, you know, the manager, Joe Maddon. Mm-hmm.
Is that why Orange Theory announced that they're the official sponsor, or if they're like the official workout program or something?
Exactly.
They had to sign up Orange Theory to get all these guys to do.
They're like, Kyle, we need you to get on the bike, man. Yeah. You're going to have to competitively exercise.
I kind of have mixed emotions about that. A part of me thinks, okay, that's good. You know, everyone, discipline, eat well, get on the same page. But then look, when they, remember the year they won? I mean, they were kind of partying it up. Yeah, Joe Maddon had like the zoo animals on the field, and they're all dressing up.
Yeah,
and
there's a question about when you're starting to tinker with the difference between focus and looseness, if you will.
Yeah.
That's not even a word. But, you know, Joe Maddon runs a pretty loosey-goosey ship there, and that's what's made him successful and a World Series champion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they don't want that. They want something else in Chicago. So it'll be interesting. Right now, it's early. I mean, I think we're not at must-win territory. I think it's must-win. It's a must-win April weekend against the Brewers.
That's funny.
In Milwaukee this weekend?
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate to say it. I mean, we got the White Sox I'm very optimistic about. But if the Cubs go in and continue to play this lifeless baseball and lose the two games or three games in Milwaukee, they're going to be 9 games back.
Yeah, it's no worries. No lead is insurmountable.
You guys think there's time?
Yeah, oh, there's time.
I just as a baseball fan, to be that to find yourself more than 6 games back in the first week of the season, that's not a good start.
Yeah, but then you can say like, oh, it's all right. We still have if it was like halfway through the season, like I'm gonna start getting a little nervous.
True.
Season just started. I can't be in the tank already for not even a week. Speaking of the White Sox and the Mariners,
yeah.
I want to mention, because it was one of my favorite jokes, you're doing a podcast called Lower Wacker Live, which is essentially your take on the news, observations, and what's going on.
Right.
And you mentioned in the one that was released today that the Seattle White Sox opener is going to really cause a strain in Tom Pachorik's life.
Tom Pachorik's life.
I thought that was hilarious.
He was a Seattle Mariner.
You can find Laura Wacker Live podcast, wherever you find podcasts.
Yeah, we have a new daily podcast we do where I make fun of the news, so you don't have to. That's how we're kind of going with. And
should I listen to this? Or?
Yeah, it's fun. It's
like
just
an onion?
Yeah, it's kind of like the onion. It's kind of like what I did with the carryout for the download. But we do it every day, and it's available on Spotify and iTunes, and it was just released this week. We just started, and that was one of the points of the that I made in the Lower Wacker Live was about Yoan Moncada. Yoan Moncada is the third baseman for the Chicago White Sox, who is off to a blazing hot start.
this kid came over in the trade. He was the number one prospect in baseball, and he came over in a trade with Chris Sale. So I think it's fair to say that we won that trade because everybody knows that you evaluate any trade in the third season, first week of the season. That's how you do it. I know Chris Sale won a World Series with the Red Sox last year, so give that up. But Yoan Moncada, based on the first four games of this season, I think we won the trade. That's how I see it. But he is playing Frank Thomas, and my favorite show that I watch every night is The Whip Around. It's a baseball highlight show, and Frank Thomas is one of the pundits on the analysts, if you will. And he said that Yoan Moncada is good or better than Manny Machado. And he said that it's going to take some time for this kid to figure it out, and he's starting to click. He's never seen better hand-eye coordination in any player in Major League Baseball. And he has glowing reviews of Yoan Moncada, and he's kind of turning it on. Moncada is not striking out, and he's starting to hit the ball every which way. So maybe we're into seeing what everybody saw, this guy being the number one prospect in baseball a couple years ago. And if that comes to fruition and they can get something out of Eloy Jimenez and obviously Jose Abreu's off to a good start, there is some optimism on the south side of Chicago right now. Their pitching staff has started off pretty well. I think, what are they, 2-4 right now? They're in that weird space. But, you know, if they have a good showing against a very hot Seattle Mariners team who started hot, but if they can take care of business this weekend at the G-Rate, I think we might see something, some excitement from the south side of Chicago. That's my take. That's my hot take. You'll hear a lot of that tomorrow morning as I'm in for Steve Cochran. And it's all White Sox. It's the home opener broadcast. It's going to be all hot takes, positive hot takes from Justin. All right, we'll come back. Patty Vasquez coming up next here on 720 WGN. All right, that's going to do it for Extension 720 tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next here on 720 WGN. You got big plans for the weekend, Andre Darlis?
I am actually taking the weekend off.
Oh, nice.
No weekend break for me, but back next Saturday for the weekend break.
Oh, there you go.
And so, back here for the reporter show.
So when you
on
say
Monday.
The weekend break, that is what you do for GNTV.
That's what I do for WGNTV, yeah. The weekend break. It's a feature segment. Anna Balaval does Around Town Monday through Friday, and I do the weekend break on Saturday and Sunday.
Awesome.
It's all features.
I know,
it's all fun.
It's great. So you get the weekend. You get the weekend off.
I did. I took the weekend off. Back for the reporter show on Monday, and back to weekend break next weekend.
Well, I will see you next week.
Yeah, sounds good. Have a good weekend.
You too.